Hello, everybody, and welcome to the DavidBix.com Wrestling Podcast for Sunday, February 18th, 2007. And I am joined by someone who's done just about everything he can in the wrestling business, fan club president, referee, wrestler, manager, booker, executive, promoter for about a second, author, head of Tully Blanchard Enterprises, J.J. Dillon. How you doing?
Hey, David. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. So, I guess to start, plug your book and your website, jjdillon.com, and the book, which, and this is not just to put you over, one of the absolute best wrestling books I've read, Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls, and just absolutely fantastic, just because you've taken, you know, notes and just kept so much detail about your career and just some insight into Vince McMahon and some other stuff that you just won't seen anywhere else. Just absolutely fantastic. I recommend everyone pick that up at jjdillon.com.
I appreciate the kind words. I started my website first, jjdillon.com, a couple of years ago when I was considering a career in real estate that never really got off the ground, never actively pursued it, but I was very pleased with the website and decided to leave it up there. And then when I was approached about doing my autobiography by Scott Teal, who also did Ole's book and recently has done Ivan Koloff and several others and is a great historian and a very gifted author. And he approached me, and so the website was obviously jjdillon.com was a natural in order for me to have fans go there to find the book because it wasn't available in bookstores. And the response has just been great. The feedback, I'm proud to say, echoes basically what you said. And I did keep great records throughout my career, and I think that really helped Scott Teal in terms of his research. I had basically done it all for him in that sense. And it really, where I moved around a lot early in my career, like going back to Amarillo territory a couple of times, going back to Florida. As time passes, you kind of have a tendency to forget who was in the territory the first time, second time, and my notes were a big help in that sense. So that I think the accuracy is well documented, and just the timing of my career. I started as a fan in the mid-50s, and so my life story, you know, pretty well parallels the history of modern wrestling, if you're just interested in how wrestling has evolved. And I have the unique position of having done so from the inside, both, as you said, as a referee wrestler right up off the line, and worked with Vince McMahon at an executive level for 7.5 years, and then the WCW that they went out of business. And so my perspective was on the inside. So in terms of I've had people say, as a textbook on wrestling, this is wrestling 101. If you pick this up, it'll give you a good understanding of how the wrestling business operates. And even if you're not a diehard wrestling fan, I've had many fans pick it up, and then the wife, who wasn't as big a fan, picked it up and read it and found it interesting too, because it is a good human interest story. It's about a kid that had a dream and then followed his dream.
Couple of quicker questions before we get to the more in-depth topics. Something I was just thinking of that I didn't actually have in my notes as far as what I wanted to ask, because I remember you noted in the book that your office plaque and everything, when you were in the WWF, said James J. Dillon. It did not say James Morrison. And that got me to thinking about a few months ago when superstar Billy Graham was not allowed on a plane because his driver's license said Billy Graham, or his medication said Wayne Coleman. I was just wondering, how does something like that work? Like, were your checks made out to J.J. Dillon, or were they made out to Jim Morrison?
No, everybody knew, from the bookkeeping side of the business, any legal documents were under my legal name, my paycheck, mm-hmm. just like everybody else's, and I had a social security number like everybody else, mm-hmm. and my plane tickets when I traveled as well. And of course, you know, that was at a different time before 9/11, and there wasn't so much scrutiny in those days. You could rush up to a gate at the very last minute and be able to get on a plane without any problem. And of course, now they're very leery of situations like that. But when I first went there, I think Vince specifically asked me, he said, how do you want to be called? You know, and I was had worked with virtually everybody that was working for the WWF at the time, earlier in my career, with very, very few exceptions. And of course, they all knew me as J.J. Dillon. So I said, it just probably will seem simpler just to continue much in the same way. And it's just like everybody called George Steele, George Steele, instead of Jim Myers. Though most people knew that, George the Animal Steele was his wrestling name. Mm-hmm. But my company ID had J.J. Dillon on it with my picture. So, but that was really an internal thing. And I found it interesting. I think I mentioned in the book there was a lot of people that once I was there for a while, because I really did try to adapt a very professional demeanor. And there were some people, which was early in my career when I worked in other places, virtually everybody that worked on smaller scale with smaller companies all were wrestling fans. And when I got to the WWF, I was a little bit surprised to see that there were a lot of people that were there. Not that it was just a job, because I don't think Vince hired people that it was just a job, but it didn't necessarily mean that they were diehard wrestling fans. But he did encourage people to watch the TV so that you were familiar with the product. But there were people there who, after I was there for a while, were surprised to find out that I had a career of my own.
So, let's see, what other do I have over here before getting to the juicier stuff? Do you still have the films of your early matches that you mentioned in the book?
Yeah, I actually, there was an old Super 8 camera, black and white, no sound, that someone took and a shot of my very first match, which was like an add-on match to what was then the WWE card in Vineland, New Jersey, where I wrestled a local kid. And I kept that in a footlocker all these years, and it was only recently, with all the stuff that I sent to Scott Teal to either put on disc so that he could pick and choose to add to the book, along with photos, he transferred it over to DVD. So I actually have footage of that very, very first match. And I have some very early footage, of my first month or months in the business, because I actually did, as most guys start in the business, a lot of TV matches.
Do you have any other tapes just documenting your career?
I'm probably like a lot of other guys in the business at the time that it's all happening. You don't think of it in terms of, you know, possible historical perspective some point down the line. And so I did not save a lot of tapes. I did save some of the early tapes that Crockett put out of mm-hmm. Great American Bash and Starcade and that kind of thing. But a lot of collectors out there did save a lot of those old shows, and there's a guy down in Mount Airy, North Carolina, Dick Bourne, who came up to me at one of the fan fests and said, I have such a wealth of material during that time of the 80s with the Horsemen, and would you like me to put it together for you at some point? And, how do you ask somebody to do that, because of the hours involved? But it was a labor of love on his part, and it took several months. And all of a sudden I saw him again, and there he had it, and he put a label on it and really fixed it up nice. So I have a couple hour DVD, and he actually gave me a second version that has a lot of the highlights during that era where I was personally involved. So I do have that as something to look back on and to share with my children. So forth.
What else? What were your impressions of working with Chris Colt?
Chris Colt. The business was all new to me back at that time, and I just was excited, and I think like any young guy breaking into the business, just kind of in awe of everything that's going on around you. Certainly the superstars at that time, like the Sheik and Bobo Brazil and the Mighty Igor and Wild Bull Curry and Tex McKenzie and Ernie Ladd was back there. But one of my first, what I consider to be my first official match, was a tag match with the Hells Angels. And I remember Chris Colt. I don't remember how much time I ever spent with him. And I can't say that I ever got to know him personally, but, people in the business talk and say he was a bizarre character, as was his partner. And, I'm just happy that, in my history that I have his name along with a lot of others that I had the pleasure to work with.
He's just one of those guys that intrigues me, maybe because he's sort of before my generation. There's not a lot of tape of him. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know, but. Let's see what else. Because I've heard some conflicting stories on this, and I guess you could definitely settle this. Dick Murdoch's punches. Did he just sock people with them, or did he just pull it perfectly and make it look like he just hit the hell out of you?
I think that Dick Murdoch threw the best punch in the business, period. Mm-hmm. He was that good. He was a big raw-boned kid, and I could imagine around Amarillo when guys would want to challenge him, I'm sure he could hit like a mule, and the stories I heard of his reputation around town, that was the case. But he would throw a punch and you would feel the hairs on your end of the nose, just knowing that it was there and it was that close. And he just was a very, very gifted guy. It came so easy to him, and I know this past 2 years, when Dave Meltzer's done the Observer Hall of Fame, Murdoch's name has been up there, and he's been right on the cusp, and Larry Matizak out of St. Louis, where Murdoch appeared a lot, and myself, because I worked early in my career a program on top of Murdoch for a full year, really have an appreciation of what a great, great talent was and how really underappreciated that he was in terms of his ability. I really think Dick Murdoch could have been a viable world champion. I just think all the promoters looked at him as someone who was very carefree and not lackadaisical, but just enjoyed life. And I think they were afraid that maybe he was someone that wouldn't go out there and make a commitment to be on the grindstone of traveling territory to territory and the work schedule that was involved. I feel, and Larry Matizak shares that feeling, that Murdoch would have been a great, great champion. And he deserves to be in whoever has a Hall of Fame for wrestling, whatever the criteria, Dick Murdoch deserves to be there.
I agree. I think that because he keeps gaining support this year, each year, I think that either this year or next year, I think he probably will make it into the Observer Hall of Fame.
I hope so. He deserves it.
Yeah, I think at this point it's just kind of an inevitability. Because he keeps gaining a little bit each year, and I think last year he was pretty close. I think he was in the like high 50% range, and he needed 60 to get in, so it was very close. But you think that if he had been given the shot as world champion, you think he would have committed himself to it? And you think he would have?
I think he wouldn't have, but I think he would have been a great, great champion.
Now, you spent a decent amount of time in the Maritimes up in Canada. And do you think that the season sort of style that they did up there of the promoting, do you think that could have worked anywhere else?
That's hard to say because the investment to produce a wrestling show, to develop talent, takes time and there's always risks involved. And the formula in the Maritimes, was really dictated to them. It wasn't really by choice, because the only arenas they had that they could work were the hockey arenas. And in the wintertime, the ice was down, and it would not have been practical to try and put something over. I mean, I've worked in arenas where they put, like, boards down over the ice and set up chairs, and it's brutal for the fans. It's brutal for everybody trying to work in that environment. And the hockey arenas in Canadian Maritimes, I think during hockey season, get used every day anyway. So they had to figure out a way to be able to work their season around the spring, as soon as the ice was down, and into the fall when it was time for the ice to go down again for the fall hockey season. And they had to produce their show, have talent, and be able to get talent over and get talent over quickly to be able to create the issues and generate the interest. And they were great people. I always have a soft spot because I really got my break up in there, the first break I had in my second territory. And the Cormier family, Leo Burke, is, again, probably one of the really true great workers in our business. I mean, all the family. I didn't see Rudy work that much, but I was told that he was solid. I know that Beast is certainly solid, probably the most traveled. And Bobby Kay, the younger one, was certainly very qualified as well, but they just never got the notoriety because of where they were from and the fact that they spent so much time working around their home.
I know that Bret Hart rates Leo Burke as, well, either him or Dynamite Kid as the best guy he's ever wrestled with.
That does not surprise me. I didn't get to see Dynamite that much, but I wrestled Leo that one summer up there. We had a series of cage matches inside of period of a week, and I was the champion, and in order to not lose the title, it meant that I had to, in the major towns anyway, I don't think it was the full 7 nights, as I discussed it years later with Leo, but I think for the 7 nights that we worked together, we actually went an hour inside a cage where, you know, there's no rolling outside to take a break, and I think at least one of them, there were 2 out of 3 fall matches. I think at least one of them, we went the whole hour and they were never even out of fall. So Leo was, he was kind of a, he was a Pat O'Connor. He was a Dory Funk. He had a lot of skills. Very believable. I see a lot of Bret Hart really in Leo Burke as well. And Leo eventually moved out to Calgary, I went through a divorce, moved out to Calgary, and when Bret Hart had a training facility or was associated with a training facility, Leo Burke was their head trainer.
Yeah, I know that Bret and Leo Burke, I know they helped train at least a few guys. I think Test, Ken Shamrock, maybe Edge later on. I know at least a few of the guys that ended up in WWE. Now, in your book, and at least also in the shoot interview with Jim Cornette, you discussed the time you worked with El Santo, where you weren't exactly sure who he was, and at first you didn't want to put him over. And, you know, you ended up acquiescing. But besides that part, I was wondering, what were your impressions just of working with him? As someone
I express it in the book. I certainly knew the name El Santo, because even in the early 70s in the border towns around El Paso, it was not unusual to see billboards for milk with El Santo's picture on it, on the milk carton. He was, you know, a huge star at that point, making the action movies in Mexico. So I certainly was familiar with the name, though I had never actually seen him wrestle or gone into to Mexico to watch wrestling. And when he was coming in for the week, he obviously had an impact even at that stage of his career. He was, you know, I'd just be guessing, I would estimate he might have been in his 60s even. And to look at him in street clothes, he certainly didn't look very formidable, but he was like a god to the Hispanic. And it wasn't a point of not wanting to put El Santo over. It just was a hot, you know, if you're a wrestler, you're a heel. You come into a territory like Amarillo. The baby faces are established, the guys that you're going to be working with night in and night out, because the Funks live there. So they were certainly crowd favorites. Same thing with Dick Murdoch, huge crowd favorite. Ricky Romero, who was Hispanic, had been there a long time, and the Hispanic fans had adopted him as there was a large contingency, you know, pockets of it, not maybe everywhere, of Native Americans, but the Indians, and they adopted him as well. So the match, and I don't remember who my partner was myself against Santo and Ricky Romero, and we had a big house, and, you know, fans should go home happy, but my thinking is, you know, if I'm going to lose a fall, let me lose a fall to the guy that's here that I'm going to continue to make money with. Santo's going to be here and gone. Of course, in hindsight, you know, the fans came to see El Santo, and if El Santo had not been himself and done all the things that they anticipated that he should have done, then the fans would have been disappointed. So, you know, that's part of the learning curve of not only myself, but anybody in the business. You know, in the beginning, you know, it doesn't take too long, and you think in your own mind that you've got it all figured out. And I found it as my career went on and on, you really never, ever stop learning. And that was a learning experience where, and I say so in my book, I think it's one of the few times that that my ego really got the best of me when it shouldn't have. And I never thought of myself as someone that had any kind of an ego problem whatsoever.
Okay. For what it's worth, he would have been about 40 then. And it really just amazes me, though. It just, any way you put it, it understates how big a star he was. Because, you know, the day of his death is a national holiday. You know, yes. It's just...
Yeah. Yeah, that's why, as I say, years later, I really... came to understand the significance of just being able to be in the ring with him. And that's why I continue to talk about it. And last year at Clear Cauliflower Alley, I became a lifetime member and went to the reunion in Las Vegas for the first time last year. And one of the people honored was Neil Mascaris. And, I've wrestled Mascaris. I've been on cards with Mascaris. And it wasn't until Cauliflower Alley that I was reminded, you know, that he too has been a huge star in all over the world, but obviously he still lives in Mexico and actually still, you know, wrestles a handful of dates. And I want to say Mascaris is, if I'm not mistaken, probably in his 70s, early 70s, but in unbelievable physical condition.
Yeah. Yeah, people aren't sure how old he is. I think he's one of those guys, I think also like Abdullah, who people aren't really sure how old he is. Iron Sheik, too, where he's sort of, you sort of hear a couple different birth dates for him. But, anyway, you worked Calgary for about a week, right?
Yes.
Now, even for about that week, were the trips as notoriously tough as people say they were?
Oh, I came back from Japan where, you know, you're basically, you know, somebody drives you in a bus or you take the train and, you know, for the time that you're there, you're pretty well pampered. And to go to Calgary, I wanted to go to Calgary because I'd been with, Sakurada, who was Kendo Nagasaki in Japan. And I've been friends with both he and Mr. Ito, for a long time. And of course, everybody that's been in the business has heard the stories of Calgary and Stu Hart and the Dungeon and Ed Whalen and the TV. And I had it on a kind of a list in my subconscious of places that I wanted to go before I ended my career. And, that was on my list, as was, working in Oregon for, Felton Owen and Don Owen. And so I, coming back from Japan, it was a natural thing. My You know, my ticket allowed me to go through there, so that, you know, it was not a transportation issue involved, and I, you know, I had a reputation in the business, and Stu knew who I was, and it just was a great opportunity for me, even for a week, to be able to go there and work the territory and work the TV.
Now, you're actually an interesting statistic in wrestling history. You are the last non-WWF wrestler to ever work at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, somebody reminded me of that well after the fact, and I never really thought about it. So I thought, in looking at the situation, that this is the time when Vincent DKM, Vince Jr., was spreading out. And in the old days, his father, Vincent J. McMahon, Vince Sr., was a member of the National Wrestling Alliance. And even though he ran his own operation, recognized his own champion, he still was a member in good standing and very, very well respected and well liked by all the other promoters. And, you know, he would do favors to have people come in and out and wrestle on Madison Square Garden cards, which I think maybe made the Garden a little special as well, but it wasn't a matter of a lot of these guys coming in and helping draw so much as it was just the prestige of having wrestled on Madison Square Garden. But once Vince, you know, drew a line in the sand and it was obvious, you know, what he was doing, you know, there was no... You know, there were no more political favors. There was no need for him. There wasn't anybody even asking about him. If anything, they were trying to figure a way to stop this guy, not to ask favors of him. And, you know, I was working down in Florida at the time with Eddie Graham. And as I talk about in my book, it was kind of late in my career. I would have been like 40, 41 years old at the time. I started late. I was almost 29 when I started full time, and the years of working on top with Leo Burke in the Maritimes and with Dick Murdoch. I mean, I've been managing now for a while, so I wasn't in the ring in that kind of ring shape, you know, to go hard every night like I had done earlier in my career. So that I kind of thought maybe the Madison Square Garden thing was something that just would never happen. I mentioned it to Eddie Graham, that, which was true as a kid in the mid-50s, late-50s. You know, I would go from Trenton, where I was born, up to Madison Square Garden a lot of times, and remember seeing Dr. Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham many times in the Garden. And, you know, I told him that. You know, here I am down in Florida working for Eddie Graham, when I'd gone to see him in Madison Square Garden as a kid. And I just said, you know, it was being from that area would have been one of my dreams to be able to say that I wrestled in the Garden, but you know, this is always somewhere else, and Trent somewhere else, that it just never happened, and not that I just kind of said it in passing, and Eddie Graham didn't comment at the time, but came up to me later in the day, and he said, that would have been a big deal for you, wouldn't it, to actually be able to wrestle and say that you were in Madison Square Garden. I said, yeah, it really would have meant something. And he said, well, I would like to make a phone call to the senior, who was still alive at that time. His health was not good. And of course, we didn't know really how bad his health was at that time, but he was a heavy smoker and he was suffering from lung cancer. And anyway, I told Eddie, I said, I can't ask you to do that. And he never even said anything, just went and walked off, and I didn't really even think anything more of it. And the next day, when I saw it, he says, you're booked in Madison Square Garden the next month, the next show, and gave me the date. And just, he could have blown me over with a feather. And I couldn't thank him enough. But I called Vince Sr., who I had known on a conversational basis since I first broke in the business as a referee. And I wanted to call and personally thank him and let him know how much that meant to me, and knowing that, you know, that it was strictly a gift for me to be on the Garden card. I certainly wasn't going to sell any tickets. At least I didn't think so. And of course, he was very gracious and very happy to be able to do it for me, and having known me all those years and knowing how much it meant to him. So that's really how it all came down. And in fact, Vince Sr. wasn't at the Garden that night. His health was, I guess, that bad. I remember Vince Jr. being there, and I then remember Jim Barnett, who was working in the office with Vince, was there that night. But it was my only appearance in Madison Square Garden, and probably if I had to pick one match in my whole career, you know, that might have been it, only because it was Madison Square Garden.
Now, speaking of Eddie Graham, you basically learned the ropes as far as booking from him. What points did he really stress the most as far as how did he get guys over? Basically, you know, what did he do? How did he lay out a program?
Well, I basically learned from everyone that I was ever around. I learned from the Cormiers up in Canada because they had to get me over, and I was not the typical monster heel that they'd had seasons before, so they had to do whatever they had to do to focus attention on me and get me over. And some of that I wasn't aware of as it was happening. I thought about it after and said, oh yeah, well, they did this and they did that. They were going to not leave any stone unturned as far as the effort to get me over. And of course I went to Amarillo with the Funks, and I think the Funks were, you know, they learned so much from their father, and I have tremendous respect for the Funks, especially Terry Funk and his knowledge of the business. I think he was always ahead of the curve and could always foresee the direction that the business was going, and was a very, very shrewd guy. He was always looked upon as being a little bit crazy in the ring, and which he was, but he was crazy like a fox. He was a very smart man, and I think Eddie Graham had an influence on all these people, the same as he had on Dusty Rhodes, that was a big star, before I ever got to Florida. Same thing with Bill Watts. And I don't know what it was about Eddie. I'm told that he only had about an 8th grade education, and that he was a street smart guy and learned the lesson by going through life. But he was a master of human psychology, the psychology of a wrestling match. And what I remember most was his attention to detail, that, I'd seen finishes where something could happen and somebody could, there are guys that can map a finish out and say A to B to C to D without really any flow or logic of why A goes to B, why B goes to C. Where with Eddie, and sometimes when you would sit down and go over a finish with him, it would be a 20-30 minute process because he shared that attention to detail with you when you were sitting down going over something, so that you could understand not only what you were doing, but why you were doing it and how it fit into to the big picture of where you ended up. He didn't do things just to be doing them. He did so with a reason. And if there wasn't a logical reason why something was going to happen, then he would search for something else that would be logical in a sequence of things. And in terms of getting people over, I mean, I like Jack Briscoe was a great amateur champion, and Jack became the anointed one. And to simplify it, I've heard the comment made that Eddie used to put Jack Briscoe in impossible situations where it looked like that he couldn't overcome them, and time after time after time, he would rise to the occasion in these impossible situations. And after you do that enough times, all of a sudden the fans just, hey, this guy is really something special. And that really was, to simplify an explanation, really Eddie's formula.
Now, that leads to a question that I had. You went to WWF in 1989 to take some of the load off in helping Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson book. What really were the differences in booking a territory like you were, when you booked Central States or the Maritimes or the Carolinas, and booking the WWF as it was in 89 and then into the 90s?
I think the big difference is that on the smaller territories, you worked within a small geographical area, and whatever those fans were educated to is the framework that you worked within as far as booking, matchmaking, writing TV, and so forth. Certainly, in Detroit with the Sheik, it was, you know, balls to the wall and just a wild, you know, way of doing things, because that was the Sheik style, and he was over so big with the fire and all the things that he did and the fork and the blood. And you got to Florida and everything there was more, almost like, a amateur philosophy. If you took amateur and legitimately turned it professional, that's the framework of what you were working around. You didn't have the wild extremes, and if you did something, I mean, it was something wild, it was really, really out of the norm and a big deal and something that needs to be explained. So the point I'm getting to is that the styles from territory to territory differed so greatly, and the big difference was, whether it was Amarillo, whether it was Florida, you know, whether it was Watts's territory, you know, whether it was the Sheik's territory, or Fritz von Erich or Geigel in Kansas City, you basically were running weekly towns. So you were geared a little bit differently. You were always concerned about not doing something too off the wall to risk possibly discrediting your business, because Tuesday night in Dallas, you knew you were coming back there next Tuesday night, and you wanted to make sure that everybody was there that night, came back, and you hoped that they walked away and combined with whatever you did on TV that week to possibly motivate some other people to come out so that your house would go up. And that same philosophy, you know, whether you were Tuesday in Dallas or whether you were Tuesday in Tampa, knowing you're coming back the following Tuesday, what have you. Once you got to the WWF, you're now looking at a promotion that is strictly national and actually international, but mainly national, where even Madison Square Garden was only run every third or fourth week. Some towns you came to once a month, some towns were six times a year. So what you did was a different philosophy. There wasn't a concern that you were going to do something that would alienate the fans, because you knew you weren't going to come back in 3 to 6 weeks or sometimes 6 months, and that there was a lot of TV in between that would help you know, cover the situation with whatever happened in the house show. Now, that doesn't mean that you didn't care. It just was a different philosophy, and it was more of making the fans happy, where in the smaller territories there were a lot more what I would call heat situations that you had to do by necessity sometimes, just to keep that intensity level much higher than you did if you were only coming back every 3 to 6 weeks.
Interesting. Now, something that I guess it happened in other places, but was sort of more of a criticism of the WWF in that period, was that guys would always wrestle the exact same match at different shows. Now, obviously, there were guys who were matched up against each other every night in other territories, too. So, was that something stressed by the management, or was that something that the guys decided to do because they were wrestling so many dates?
I think, you know, I never really understood why it happened. I think it goes back to when you're coming back on a week to week basis, there is a greater pressure to deliver on that night because you can't afford to alienate any fans and have the house the following week drop because you either got lazy or you were doing something that was so predictable, if that makes any sense. And like I said, I programmed with Dick Murdoch for almost a solid year in Amarillo. And we would find that Amarillo and Lubbock maybe are only 100, 110 miles apart. And I could wrestle Murdoch on a Wednesday night in Lubbock and wrestle him on a Thursday night in Amarillo. And fans didn't travel as much in those days. They would go to the weekly show, but they wouldn't go to Lubbock and then drive 100 miles to go to Amarillo the next day. But I would find that the fans in Lubbock were buying into something on one night, and the match would go great. And then the next night in Amarillo, you would start in a very similar fashion and all of a sudden get this feeling that, this crowd's not buying into this one. I'm not getting the reaction that I did last night. And so you had to learn to listen to the people, to understand, what you had to do, which meant sometimes change gears, go in a different direction. And I'm not talking about, somebody in the crowd yelling, boring, boring, all of a sudden, which you see a lot of, or I have seen a lot of, where guys jump up through a flurry of things, kind of a knee-jerk reaction to a couple fans yelling, boring. I'm talking about, in that era, the guys were great performers who had a lot of confidence in their ability to control the situation and control the emotions of the crowd, not be controlled by the emotions of the crowd. And because in the WWF, the guys were coming back to towns every 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 months, if they got a match that worked for them, I saw it. They would go out and basically do a carbon copy match, really without regard to the reaction of the fans, because that was not the same concern as it was the guys working weekly towns in smaller territory.
The thing that I always found especially strange about it, and I guess this is why they stopped doing, except on for MSG, the various cable broadcasts of the house shows, is that there were people who could see multiple house shows and see the same match going on, and I guess that's why they stopped it when around the time you came in there. That, besides they'd show it on primetime, but there would be people who could get, say, MSG Network and New England Sports Network and see people doing the same match on the Boston and MSG shows. Now, I guess since you were there then.
Right. And that was a factor in them having to change, because they would, in the old days, they would, just like the small territories, they would take a match issue and bicycle it around to all the towns. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the New England Sports Network and the Garden Network, it got to the point, it's like with the Saturday Night Main Event or Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. They would take a match and wait until it had been everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that was like the last stop, so that they were trying not to give the match away until they had gotten all the box office out of it from the arenas. But that was a problem with the Garden Network and with the New England Network. And there was actually a network in
Philly.
Out of the Spectrum in Philly too. And the same thing happened there, that it was very productive for the promotion to have that revenue coming in, until they realized that they reached the point where they were paying the price for it by how far out that network expanded. And then the problem of what happens when you try to take those matches, it's no longer a unique match, in Syracuse and all the other upstate towns out of New York.
Interesting. Now, at what point did you become head of talent relations?
I guess I went in there just as a quote unquote agent. I didn't really have a title for me, and I worked in the office under Pat Patterson, who was the vice president of talent relations at that time. And Pat did the preliminary payoffs. I helped with all of the matchmaking and all of the TV writing and oversaw the travel initially, which was a big task because when I first got there, there were three tours on any given night, and then they all had to funnel in for TV, which was every third week, and then, you know, either go home or funnel back out. So that was an education, but I was always a detail person, so I really enjoyed the challenge, and I'd been on the road myself, so, you know, I knew, I would think as a talent thought, and at the same time realize that I had a responsibility to the promotion, you know, in terms of doing everything as cost effectively as possible and making sure the talent got in there where you didn't risk, them taking a last flight and all of a sudden having the flight canceled and then guys not being able to get to a town in time. So I learned a lot doing that. And then along the way, there was, the one scandal where, you know, Terry Garvin, was let go, and Terry reported directly to Pat at that time. Terry was in charge of all the rings for the company and reported to Pat. And so when all of that blew up, kind of Pat was at least temporarily, because Terry reported to him, kind of a casualty from that. And so that created an opportunity where, you know, I was elevated to that position. Pat came back approximately six months later, and which I had no problem with Pat coming back because it was kind of an unfortunate situation that he got caught in terms of, you know, possibly being a scapegoat for something that he wasn't directly responsible for. But by the time Pat had that time off and came back, I had been elevated to talent relations as the vice president, and Pat didn't want to do that aspect of the business anymore as much. And so, you know, I was doing the preliminary payoffs as a courtesy. When Pat came back, he would look at them before we sent him on to Vince. You know, and Pat would make suggestions. But Pat came back and really, slowed down a little bit and still, was involved with the creative and then got more involved with going to the town and helping guys with their matches and so forth.
Now, I guess this is something you probably would have been involved in. How did the working agreements with USWA and later Smoky Mountain come about?
You know, I don't really have specific recollection of how those things happened. I left there in 96, so I'm not sure when those relationships...
those were in 92 and 93.
92 and 93. And again, it evolved where I was, as Vice President of Talent Relations, kind of phased away from the creative, where I would sit in from time to time, you know, sitting with pay-per-views and so forth. But it really, because of the company had grown so much, became a full-time job. And also, you know, talent contracts came into being that were, in the early days when I first got there, there was one basic contract that basically was just laid out the rights and really gave the talent little or nothing other than opportunity, and that changed during that period of time. So being able to stay on top of that and knowing who was under contract and when it expired, and the travel aspect, and we started doing more internationally because there were periods of time when there were lulls, and you also went from three towns down to two towns, which eventually went down to one town for a while. So there were more guys on the card, so there was a little concern of not having too many guys on the card so that the guys that were there could still make money. The talent relationship, the talent management really became a full-time job, and I think Bruce Pritchard, maybe Jim Ross, you know, might have been a little bit more involved in the satellite setups.
Now, would the scouting and stuff have been your job, or would that have been more delegated out at that point?
That would have been more delegated out. I don't know that I did any going out scouting talent. When talent came in, they were either recommended or Vince knew who they were and wanted to bring them in. Usually the meeting would be Vince, myself, and whoever the talent was.
Okay. Now, given the way that, especially earlier in your run there, WWF was sort of very, you know, isolationist, don't acknowledge that anyone else exists, how did the Japan deals come about? Because, you know, it was very, you know, weird that, you know, they were basically, you know, within their own universe as far as wrestling goes, and then all of a sudden, you know, you'd have, you know, Tenryu show up on WrestleMania, or you'd have the Tokyo Dome show with Hogan, and then they'd put that on a Coliseum video. How'd that stuff come about?
Well, I think there along the way, became a realization that that for the growth of the company, they had to go beyond just national and look at international. And especially, there had been such growth that all of a sudden it was kind of not a shock factor, but that there were times when you know, business would get soft domestically. And so the plan was always to look to where else we could go. And of course, England and then Germany were the first. And initially, you know, that was hugely successful, that the TVs had run there for a while, and all they had to announce was that they were coming for the first time. And they all sold out immediately with big ticket prices. And that then allowed to rest some of the domestic markets because of the guys being able to, you know, to go to Europe and do so well. Japan, on the other hand, had already had established promotions. And so the thought was, okay, you know, how can we generate some revenue and work in cooperation with somebody? Because that's a different animal there. Got established promotions, and we can't, you know, we can't look at going in there and looking at it as just an extension of Japan, extension of England, Germany, etc. So the first, the feeler of meetings as to which company, you know, would have the most interest in a working relationship, and it happened to be Baba. And, you know, in a case like that, a lot of times, you know, what's necessarily in time a good deal for me is not a good deal for you, or vice versa. So that worked for a while. And I think we had one situation where, I can't remember who it was that we were going to give somebody the main event for one of the Tokyo Dome shows, and he got hurt or something. And then we had to scramble to send somebody else. And it's like, any other situation, anytime you're trying to substitute the main event, especially if you, you know, got a lot into it, there really is no acceptable substitution, but you know, you do what you got to do. And I think that hurt the relationship with Baba a little bit. And then when Baba didn't want to do business and New Japan didn't want to do business, then we were able to form a relationship with the man that owned Nagami Super, who was a spinoff new promotion that Tenryu was involved in. And that was a 2-year deal. And the WWF got a sizable management fee to do that. Plus, the talent was going over there on those tours, getting exposure at live events in Japan. And then once, that deal ran its course, then Vince, you know, made the decision, you know, I want to go on my own, and challenge me to, okay, you've been to Japan quite a bit, you understand the culture, there's nobody that's interested in doing business, and the deal ran its course in terms of a management fee with somebody else, so we'll go on our own, make it happen. And so, I got with Akio Sato, who I knew from my early days with Baba, and, we organized a six-event tour in Japan that, to my knowledge, was the first one the first time that a foreign promotion had ever gone to Japan and promoted wrestling in Japan. And it was, moderately successful.
Okay. Now, I'm not sure how far he had come up in the company at the time that you were there, but what were your impressions of Kevin Dunn while you were there?
I knew Kevin Dunn. His father had been in that same position prior to him. I'm sure Kevin, his power base, grew substantially, certainly after I left in 1996. But Kevin Dunn and the director, Kervin Sophies, I would say were two of the best in the business and really elevated the quality television-wise of production, which is what Vince wanted to do, to be on a level with, back in those days, the measuring stick was like, Wide World of Sports. And we were able to have a television product that had, the values, the technical values and the quality of the production that basically, came up to that level, which I think is why, they were eventually able to do business with Dick Ebersole on NBC because it had risen to that level. The other side of the coin is, and this is, again, it's personal opinion, but I think part of the uniqueness of wrestling is the fact of the spontaneity of everything. That sometimes there can be an impact to a fan thinking that they saw something that they weren't supposed to see. Which means, you go off the set for a moment and then they see something and where it was became so slick with the WWF/WWE product that it was so I don't want to use the word overproduced, but you could certainly explain that it was overproduced, that it became too slick. So that you lost some of that spontaneity. And even to the point that you could go back to Dick Murdoch. You could take Dick Murdoch and have a tight shot of a cameraman standing on the ring apron with him throwing a punch into my face. You didn't have to, which you see now, even today when I watch the WWE product, it's difficult for me to watch because they're so conditioned to doing it that way that at every impact of anything that happens, there's a camera switch.
Yeah.
And a lot of people aren't even aware. And the next time you watch a show, virtually everything that happens at whether it's a drop kick, a punch coming off the rope or something, there's a switch in cameras right at the point of impact. And whether it was by necessity to protect certain guys that weren't polished workers, but back in my day, you didn't have to do that because the guys, the style was such that wasn't necessary. And I think that has detracted over the years from the product in that it has become so predictable. Every show, when they expand out and do all these shows, they are all shot the same. They all look the same. And even Vince's notion of what he thinks a wrestler is or should be or should look like is kind of narrow as well. And so there have been times where everybody almost looks the same. And I think that's hurt the product.
About the whole predictable production thing, one thing that I've really noticed and it's become really ridiculous especially in the last year or two is that you'll notice that any match now that goes through a commercial break, it'll basically be someone gets knocked to the floor. A lot of the times it'll be the babyface and it'll be, oh no, what's going on? We'll see you back right after this commercial break. Always. Rarely will it not be like that. And it's just too slick.
Yeah, they've had success and they've fallen into a lull of of being comfortable with the level of success that they did achieve. I have always had a problem with backstage cameras. To me, there was always a certain mystery to the fans of what actually went on behind the curtains. And the minute that you take the cameras back there, yes, initially there's a little bit of wow, you know, and they're now seeing something that they didn't see before. But all of the things that happen in little skits and what have you, I think it just, it doesn't have impact anymore, and it's gotten out of hand, and I think that they have paid a price for opening that door. And I had two things that come to mind in my career were back with the Horsemen. We did two vignettes, one of which was the ambush of Dusty Rhodes in the parking lot at Jim Crockett Promotions, and another was the date with Precious in a hotel room. And in both cases, you know, I made a point in the body of the thing as it was being shot to tell the cameraman, look, you know, we're paying you good money, and, you know, this thing may be distasteful for you in the Dusty Rhodes scenario, but, you know, I'm paying you, and I expect you to keep your mouth shut and just keep shooting. And in the Precious day, it was like, okay, this thing may get hot and steamy, but keep the camera rolling, because that's what I'm paying you for. So it kind of justified why everything was going on and why we kind of forgot the camera was there, because we had already covered that and explained why it was there. And then went so far with the ambush of Dusty Rhodes. If it was so distasteful, you know, why was it aired? And I think we covered that by saying, well, you know, you're appalled by what happened and feel that we should all be arrested for assault and battery. But, you know, we fought the time. So, you know, you've been paid, Eric, whether you like it or not. I don't care whether you like it or not. We're just sending a message that, without saying so, you know, we're a bunch of bullies, and if you mess with us, you know, we're going to gang up and beat you up.
Speaking of the Horsemen being bullies, why did they have a vitamin line?
So you could grow up and be a bully like us. I don't know.
Whose idea was that?
Oh, I, you know, everything was in its infancy in terms of merchandising, in terms of licensed products, and we were so focused on the performing part of it that, you know, it wasn't a matter of selling jackets and t-shirts and vitamins. And I think, you know, that's where Crockett was trying to grow and get into things like that.
Yeah, I just never got why Four Horsemen vitamins as opposed to Dusty Rhodes vitamins. But anyway, something I found a little weird. I was just watching some tapes I got recently, and I didn't remember that you briefly hosted NWA main event with, I think, Tony Schiavone. And I found it interesting that at this point you were still a heel. You, I think, were I think it was Barry Windham, Ric Flair, but also Kendall Windham and Butch Reed at this point. But you basically, as the host of the show, you were playing it straight. And I was just wondering, was this just sort of your call? And I was just wondering why. I just found it a little bit interesting.
Yeah, it just was. I was in the office. I was paid basically a base salary for what I contributed in the office, and it was something that I don't remember if they said, "Will you do this?" or whether I said, "You know, I will do it." So somebody else doesn't have to come in the office and give up their time because I'm here anyway. And I think in the back of my mind, it was like, it probably would be good experience for me for the future to see how I did in that capacity. And I enjoyed doing it, but I soon came to figure out that it wasn't what I did best. I was not a great commentator. I could do it. I could get by short term, and I enjoyed it, but it was a learning experience for me.
Now, what did you think of Jim Crockett Jr. as a boss?
I knew Jim Crockett Sr. well, and I have very, very fond memories because that was my first territory. He was a true Southern gentleman, and he was treated as such by everyone that was there. It was Mr. Crockett this, Mr. Crockett that. The kids didn't come around that much in the beginning. I knew Jackie was a cameraman. He was probably around first, and then with Jimmy and with David. And David actually wrestled for a short period of time. I had a handful of matches with David.
He was David Finlay, right?
Yes. David's mother was scared to death that, you know, he would get hurt, and so that didn't last long. And Jimmy was the one that was a little bit older and more mature. And actually, it was Francis's husband, or one daughter, who actually ran the company for a while. And then there was a scandal where he was ostracized, and then that created an opportunity where somebody had to come in there and take over. And I don't know if it was a family decision or what, but it was Jimmy. Jimmy was always treated me very well. He was not necessarily a warm and fuzzy type of guy in terms of his personality, but he was a good guy and treated me well, and I enjoyed working for him. I think they enjoyed tremendous success, especially when they started having their program on TBS that allowed them to now tour nationally and be recognized on a level with the WWF at that time. And I think if there was a weakness or a shortcoming, it started as a family operation. There were a lot of people in there who'd been back there going to his father. And I think Jimmy didn't develop an infrastructure of professional people to be able to handle certain functions as the company grew so rapidly. And when he tried to buy Bill Watts and look at thinking beyond just Charlotte, North Carolina, I think that's where he got in trouble.
Okay. Now, a couple more quick questions before we finish up. My friend Rob Naylor insisted I ask you this because this is about his favorite wrestler and you were around then. What do you think about working with Manny Fernandez?
I enjoyed Manny. He was, you know, he was a man's man. He was a great amateur, and, you know, I don't have anything but good things to say about Manny. I enjoyed working with him, and but, you know, can't say that I knew him all that well on a personal level. Mm-hmm.
This is one of my personal favorite wrestling music videos. How did the idea for the video with you and Buddy Landell in the bar with the Smooth Operator video song come about?
You know, I don't know who picked that song, and I hate that song.
I like that song, but...
The idea was, you know, hopefully to try and create some controversy between who is the real Nature Boy. And the video was a very tongue-in-cheek, and it was like, you know, here was somebody who had been so close to Flair and knew him like the back of his hand, and trying to convey to this raw talent who looked like he was so gifted about, you know, this is not going to be as easy as it sounds, you know, but if there's anyone who knows Ric Flair, no one knows him better than I do. And I'm going to be the key to preparing you for, when you ultimately have to meet him. And on the other hand, the camera was picking up a guy who was very vain, very much full of himself, that was listening to me, but the words were going in one ear and out the other. And he would all of a sudden do something, and all of a sudden, you know, I'd roll my eyes like, you know, this is going to be quite the challenge. And that's kind of the theme that, you know, that went through this thing. And it never really, you know, had any longevity to it. You know, Buddy was a great kid and was a very good talent. He just had some demons that, that got the best of him that, that he just could never get past that to take it to the next level.
I just adore that video. It is just, I got this tape one time and I just had never seen it before and I'm just watching it and it's just so hilarious and you're just sitting at the bar and you're wearing your, you know, your suit with the big frilly, you know, shirt. And, you know, of course, there's the, you know, the big ending, which is, of course, you know, JJ, I got one thing to say. Ric Flair, move over. That's right. I said it. But
yeah, I think in many ways, you know, they talk about, you know, the vignettes and the thing. I think we were, you know, we were cutting edge for that era. We were ahead of our time.
That one was just tremendous. What else? What did you think of the Hiro Matsuda Yamazaki Corporation taking over the remnants of the Four Horsemen briefly after you left?
Well, you know, I moved on, and the time was right for me to move on because with the buyout from TBS, I was not really comfortable with everything that I was seeing. Originally, it was like, they were going to take over and not touch the wrestling product and that they were going to give the new company the advantage of the resources, both financial, of international connections to be able to package the programming and take it places that, that it maybe wouldn't have gone otherwise. When in reality, there were a lot of closet wrestling fans working in TBS that the minute that they had control of the company, you know, just couldn't resist the temptation about putting their two cents in. So, I was approached about an opportunity with the WWF and it just seemed like the timing was perfect for me to move on, kind of go full circle, having started with Vince's dad as a referee and now they were on top of the wrestling world and they were recruiting me to come there and work for them because somebody thought enough of what I had to offer. So all in all, I really felt good about it. The Horsemen had run its course. I knew that they had to then fill that gap and do something. Hiro Matsuda is someone who I have the utmost respect for. I worked with him in Florida. He was one of the owners down there. He was very, very well respected in the wrestling business as both a performer and as a gentleman and very, very well respected among the Japanese people. So, you know, it was kind of with mixed emotions to see him step in there. At least he was someone who was a departure from my style, which I think was probably good thinking on somebody's part rather than trying to duplicate. I just in one hand also felt a little sorry for him because I felt that Hiro was stepping into a no-win situation, that there was no one who was going to go in there and be able to you know, recapture that massive magic. It was something that had, you know, already run its course.
Do you consider Kendall Windham and Butch Reed to be horsemen?
Ah, boy, that's a tough question to answer. I always say that Barry Windham was one of my favorites. The combination where Barry was in that fourth spot was what I thought were the best combination in terms of working ability of everything that we could do in the ring. Kendall was a great kid, but Kendall didn't have the skills, didn't have the looks, didn't have the size of a Barry Windham, if that means anything. Butch Reed, great guy, and very, very gifted. I was treated in Kansas City, so I have an appreciation for his ability. I think there were so many changes in the Horsemen by the time it got to that point that it was such a departure from the original four that, again, I don't care who they put in there. At that point, I don't think it would have had impact.
Did you or anyone else on the booking team or in the front office when Ric Flair came into the WWF try to in some way get push the real world champion idea stronger, you know, to either get the NWA involved somehow, or was it just kind of that you knew that Vince wouldn't go for it?
I think there was a kind of a feeling in the back of the mind that in order to do that, you then have to give credibility to someone else.
Yeah.
And in order to tell that story. And that just was never going to happen. Vince had spent his whole life marketing the WWF / WWE, and we weren't professional wrestling. This was wrestling, WWF wrestling. There wasn't the world heavyweight wrestling champion. It was the WWF champion. Everybody was conditioned to think that way, and to give credibility to someone else and say champion is champion, I just knew it was something that wouldn't fly with Vince.
It always seems like there was a little bit of a missed opportunity, even though there's no way that Vince would have gone for it, because, you know, the fact that he was still NWA champion for a minute there, but yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have happened, but you know what I mean? Cause, yeah, okay. I'm not sure how to phrase this, but your book certainly gives a different insight into Vince McMahon than you'll find elsewhere. Any in brief stories off the top of your head?
No, I think as written, Seagulls is very thorough, very honest, and I think very fair.
Yeah,
I set out from the beginning to say. And I had a unique perspective in that I was at that point out of the business. I think there's a lot of people who still think maybe that phone's going to ring one more time. So they're very cautious about things that are ever said or even implied about Vince McMahon because, you know, well, maybe there's a chance I can go back there for that one more run. There, because of the circumstances with me, and my history there, that's something that I made the decision that I would never want to work there again anyway. So it wasn't like I had to hold anything back. And at the same time, I also felt that I didn't have an axe to grind with Vince McMahon or anybody else. So I wanted to be honest.
But fair.
But fair. And at the same time, if I was going to do that, I wanted to be honest and fair about assessing my own career and my strengths, my weaknesses, and I tried to do that as well. And I felt in the end, I treated everybody fairly. I've had people say, well, you know, with what you went through with Vince, you were as complimentary to Vince probably more so than you were critical of anything. And that's probably true, but that's the reality of how I really feel. It was a great opportunity for me. I learned a tremendous amount when I was there. It was just part of my continuing education. Mm-hmm. I think I understand Vince. I'm not going to change Vince. I don't think anybody else is. And so it is what it is. And again, I think I was honest and I didn't, tell any stories out of school that I shouldn't have about Vince McMahon or anybody else. And again, I think it was honest and I think it was fair. I think we could talk about it. And in the end, I think if we just settle on the fact that it was honest and fair, then I did what I set out to do.
Yeah, I agree. Just a couple more things before we go. Was the Brian Pillman contract signing press conference the only time you were identified by name on WWF TV?
May have been. I don't know. I
think it was.
It probably was. You know, that wasn't my role. That was made clear the day that I went there that my basically on-air career was over, that I was being brought in another capacity. And I was very, I could do the other if called upon, but that was not my role, and that was our understanding when I went there.
Okay. And going to more recent times, what did you think of MLW?
I've come to realize that Vince was the right place, the right time, and that anybody else that tries to come along is going to be looked upon as pale in comparison. The cost of trying to start up another company and to be able to compete and be accepted on that level is a near impossible task. And the one big thing that's missing beyond the ability to get a television clearance, beyond the ability to have the funding, is the fact that you don't have the talent in the industry.
I didn't think they were trying to compete with WWE. I thought they were just trying to be a new ECW, because they were getting kind of ridiculous. They were going with the same production company. They were flying in the same security guys from the Northeast to Florida, which was just ridiculous. But, yes. And more recently than that, last summer, you did a shot for ROH with the Cage of Death show. What did you think of that?
With Ring of Honor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was very impressed with Ring of Honor. I think they're smart enough to realize that they've got to find a niche, which they did, and they tried producing their own TV show and realized that the rewards for the cost of producing a TV show aren't there anymore. And whether they stumbled across it or whatever, they have developed a market for doing quality shows. They're smart enough to know, even when they go to a hot market like Philadelphia, that where typical thinking in years gone by was, oh, we had a great show, we need to come back next month. And they would not schedule a date for 3 or 4 months down the line. And they would move locations around and expand their circle so that when you did come with a live event, that it had some meaning. New York's a little bit of an exception. You could probably come back there with greater frequency. But they were, recording these events, and there's an audience out there that I think yearns for the old style of wrestling that's more competitive and less glitz. And I think that's what they're trying to deliver, and they're doing so with strong DVD sales. I think they've got a good business plan.
Any plans on you and Cornette doing another straight shooting soon?
I'd be open to. Jim had pages of notes, and we got through maybe half of it and talked about it would be nice to get together again sometime and continue the discussion. I would certainly enjoy doing so. I don't know, Ring of Honor, how well the thing is sold. That may have something to do with eventually whether we get back and do a second episode, but I have nothing but the utmost respect for Jim Cornette and really enjoyed the first one, and I would love to be able to do another one.
I've really enjoyed the ones that they've done with just him, and they've done him and you, Conan, Bruno, and also three with Heenan. And if anyone hasn't seen it, I highly recommend the third Cornette and Heenan, which is basically a tour of Cornette's house, and they talk about the various collectibles that he has. And that's just phenomenal. But
Jim is a very, very talented guy.
Oh, definitely. And finally, to finish up for today, as we've gone about over 80 minutes and it's just flown by, anyone you didn't get to work with that you wish you had?
Wow. I thought about this at times. I would like to have met Ricky Dozan because he was the father of modern wrestling in Japan. And of course, he died before I ever got started. I never wrestled Hulk Hogan, and I don't know that I don't go to bed at night, missing any sleep. The fact I didn't wrestle Hulk Hogan. I never wrestled Bruno Sammartino. And if I had my choice between, say, Hulk Hogan and Bruno Sammartino, I would love to have had that one time to be able to say that I was in the ring and wrestled Bruno Sammartino. But other than that, I really can't think of anybody else.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you for doing this. As I said, that just flew by. Did not feel like almost an hour and a half. And I'd love to have you on again. I'm sure we could probably fill the same amount of time just talking about WCW. But
David, I really enjoyed it, and I hope people following have enjoyed the time spent. And I encourage you to check out my website, jjdillon.com. A lot of old pictures on there. And at the top of the main page, you'll see the banner for Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls, and takes you to Crowbar Press, where you can read about seagulls along with Ole's book and Ivan Koloff's book. But Scott
Assassin's book,
nice
too.
Job setting it up where you can see the chapter headings, the content of each chapter. There's an index of through the list of names and know who I've crossed paths with and little excerpts from the book, and you get some reader feedback to people that have read the book and their comments. And I suggest that you do that. It is available now on Amazon.com. You can go there, but it's also available direct through Crowbar Press. And anybody that orders through Crowbar Press, I'm continuing to sign copies and personalize, if you so wish, at no additional charge.
Okay, well, again, I'd like to thank you, and I'd love to have you on again, and this was a blast, and it's an honor, and I'd really like to, and again, just thank you, and I'll be back on Wednesday with 15-year Southeastern Independent veteran Scotty McKeever, and I'll be trying to arrange for some other interesting shows too, and that's about it. Thank you.
All right, David, thank you, and look forward to another time. A conceptual sense double, a deviant scene, I mean. Multiple.